This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
Outside the COP25 climate conference in Madrid's December, climate activists gather to call for real action. But a small group claims we can restore the climate with technology. Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith is in with that web of small foundations and micro-investors pushing everything from carbon-grabbing concrete to seeding ocean plankton. All that, as yet another gathering of world leaders, abandons the future to more stalling and words. The world's largest climate meeting in Madrid has wrapped up. It is called the Conference of the Parties. This was COP25. There were no headlines other than world leaders agreed to let Earth slip further into climate disaster. Radio EcoShock has its own spies on site, including our regular guest, Paul Beckwith. Paul is a genuine climate scientist who often teaches at the University of Ottawa. Now he is also professor to the world with his in-depth series of climate videos on YouTube. You have to check those out. Paul, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
It's always a pleasure, Alex.
What was it like there in the trenches of suits and formal dresses all heading into closed rooms to decide whether to save the future or not?
Well, I think in general, the conference has been quite an experience for me, quite a positive experience for me personally. As far as, progress from negotiations and et cetera, that's been pretty much a bust, as expected. But today I got to meet Peter Wadhams for the first time in person and been doing press conferences with Peter Carter, and also got to meet Peter Fiakowski, who's the founder of Healthy Climate Alliance. So these are all great things for me, doing a lot of networking and so on. But I'm learning a lot. There's lots of interesting sessions set up by different countries and booths. For example, I went into the Saudi Arabia, their country's meeting rooms, and met with one of their high-level ministers. And that was interesting, an interesting experience, I must say. I can tell you more about that if you're interested.
Yeah, okay. So Peter Wadhams is the Cambridge polar expert, especially with Arctic ice. And Peter Carter, I guess, is the Canadian doctor who has started his own climate NGO.
Yes.
And the third person you told us about. So yeah, you're making some good connections there.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, Peter Wadhams, his book, A Farewell to Ice, a few years ago, I think it's been translated into 8 languages so far, and I think a 9th is in the work. It's going to be put into Spanish soon. He's still getting a lot of traction with his book, and a friend of mine, Nick Breeze, said that he's a bit of a climate journalist and has his own blog, Envisionation, I believe.
Yes, it is.
Said that Sir David King has told him that it's one of the most significant books on the Arctic and climate that he's ever read. And, of course, Sir David King is now involved quite a bit in educating people about climate, but also in looking for possible solutions.
And despite fighting off life-threatening illness, Stuart Scott was there hosting an off-site press conference with the former NASA chief scientist James Hansen. He gets the big ones.
Yes.
They proposed launching lots more lawsuits, and okay, that could work in a few democracies with functioning legal systems, like maybe the Netherlands, but I don't see it going very far in the United States. It's going to cost a lot of money and time, and no climate lawsuits will be filed in Russia or China or Saudi Arabia or the majority of the dictatorships on this planet. I think it's a waste of precious time, but what do you think, Paul?
Yeah, well, I think one of the key things that Hansen's trying to do is work with younger people, work with the younger generation. He's got a young granddaughter, Sophia, who, is getting involved, becoming very active with the climate. It kind of reminds me of David Suzuki's daughter who spoke at, I guess in 92 at Rio.
That's right.
And, almost like Greta 1.0 or something, sort of thing. But I thought, I thought I'd go and have a chat with the Saudi Arabia people because, I asked them if they were getting if it ever got to them that they were considered the bad guys of the world, the pariahs of the world, with the big bad fossil fuel industry. And
You asked them that.
Yes, I asked them if they if they, you know, ever wanted to change their image to become the good guys of the world and the climate. You know, all they would need to do would be to figure out how to remove CO2 from the atmosphere actively and to stabilize the climate while they were doing that. And, to, you know, if they put in 10 gigatons of CO2 per year, their contribution, but they managed to remove 20 gigatons a year, then nobody would end up caring about the 10 gigatons that they put in any longer. They'd be on the way to reducing CO2. I mean, there's only one number that's really important, and that's the CO2 levels in the atmosphere. You know, and as long as that continues to rise at an ever-increasing rate, we're in trouble. We're not going to solve this issue. It doesn't matter how many climate conferences there are. So I spoke to them quite a bit about carbon dioxide removal and solar radiation management, about what people are looking at, you know, about the ideas of using the best horses I would back right now in terms of carbon dioxide removal are plankton in the oceans, and also, you know, extracting CO2 and producing limestone out of it, which is the basis for cement, which was mixed with basically rock aggregate, which is also made of predominantly of things like limestone, and which is heavy in CO2 carbon. And if we could scale up those sort of industries, which Peter Fiakowski thinks we've got a good shot of doing, not with government money at all, but because it could become commercially viable, then that would go a long way to removing large amounts of CO2 from the atmosphere. So anyway, it was interesting. The Saudi Arabia people that I spoke with were very very eager. They were very interesting to hear what I had to say. So I got a lot of business cards and stuff. I said I'd send links on some of the various things. And so sometimes you just have to try different things, try different tactics.
Well, I noticed that the Heartland Institute, which is the spawn of the Koch brothers, also held press conferences, and they had so-called experts explaining climate change is either nothing to worry about, perfectly natural, or really an alarmist hoax. It's kind of like having Nazis present at a big meeting of Jewish Holocaust survivors, to my way of thinking. And I wonder how long COP25 will tolerate that and provide a stage for just outright climate denial.
Yeah, it's funny because I haven't heard of any of these people being at the COP. I know they usually show up, that they don't usually hold any events within the official COP. They don't get in. They usually hold their, you know, I could be wrong on that, but usually they hold their events just outside the event, and they put up COP25 posters and stuff, and they make it look like they're official, but it's, you know, there's nothing authentic about these groups at all. Everything is fraudulent about these groups. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if Jason Kenney and his war room people, you know, $30 million war room people to spread propaganda about the oil sands in Canada, if they weren't part of it and showed up. I mean, it's pathetic the lengths that these people will still go to. And, you know, but fortunately, they're being ignored more and more often. But like I was saying, you know, in terms of the negotiations, you know, I had reasonable hopes after Paris that stuff could be done, and that was quickly dashed. And James Hansen, I think, was spot on, you know, after Paris, saying, well, nothing's really happening and not much is going on. But this COP is similar. I mean, even being within the conference site itself and being able to go to the odd negotiation, although most of the negotiation sessions are closed to the public, some of them have feeds, live feeds that you can see, and everything's recorded, so you can see it after the fact. But basically, it follows a formula or recipe. I mean, the first, it's 2 weeks. It's a ridiculous length of time for these negotiation conferences every year is the first thing. The second thing is, you know, it's policy people and bureaucrats who are negotiating the first week, and they don't have a lot of power, I think. I mean, they can negotiate, but you really need the ministers of different countries, the MPs, et cetera, to come. And, you know, they only come in the second week to start the negotiations, and even they have limited power. And usually then towards the end, the last few days, when nothing has happened, then the presidents and prime ministers of countries come in and say, you know, last-minute negotiations. And then the conference ends, is supposed to end on the Friday, which is tomorrow, but it invariably never does. and things go over to the Saturday, and finally about, you know, late Saturday night, they say, oh, we're making some breakthrough, and then a few hours later they say, well, we've signed an agreement, tremendous breakthrough to save the world, to you know, it's all a show, it's all a game to these politicians. You know, they declare a climate emergency on the one hand, and they go and buy a pipeline the very next day, that sort of thing, not to mention any countries or politicians that would do that, but, you know, we know that's happened. So, you know, it's all a bit of a farce. And I thought it was very interesting a few days ago when Greta Thunberg was criticizing Canada and Norway for violating the human rights of children by saying one thing and doing the complete opposite on climate change. And that was talking about the fossil fuel infrastructure development. In Canada's case, the pipelines and the oil sands, and in Norway's case, the offshore oil fields.
Yes, and according to reports from Madrid by Climate Central, quote, China succeeded in delaying a key aspect of the rules of the Paris Agreement, the transparent reporting of national emissions. And to me, that's strange, Paul, because China officially aims to create what they call an ecological civilization, but they don't want to report how much greenhouse gas they pump into the atmosphere. They didn't want to make bigger promises for reductions in 2030 either. I'm really disappointed in China in particular.
Yes, I think a lot of people are disappointed in China now. I mean, after the U.S. Stepped away from climate action, you know, a lot of people thought that China would take over. You know, they could become recognized quite favorably in the world if they took over the U.S. place and took strong action on climate change. But and that's actually what they said they would do. They said they would fill that void. But, you know, clearly that hasn't happened so much. And it's just, you know, there's not enough pain yet for these politicians and world leaders. I mean, there's more and more of a movement. I mean, one of the things at this conference is people of all different groups and non-governmental organizations, booths at countries, side event talks and titles, and even main events. They're talking about climate emergency. That term is the winning term of this conference, if you like, and that's different language from a few years ago. The problem is it's still just language. It's not being matched by action yet. But I've always thought there would be this sort of tipping point in human understanding of how serious the problem is, or problems are that we face, and then a turning point or a tipping point in strong action. And we haven't got to that second part yet. But I think it's coming. It's coming close.
Radio EcoShock.
Please note our COP25 correspondent this time, Paul Beckwith, is part of several groups he advances in this interview, including the Foundation for Climate Restoration and the Arctic Methane Emergency Group. On another note, I was surprised to find longtime COP press organizer Stuart Scott was in Madrid advancing the work of contentious promoter Russ George and ocean fertilization. Travel to my show blog to find links to my two programs about Russ George and his history. Find the show blog published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. You can download all our past programs for free, courtesy of our supporters, at that same site, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are talking with Paul Beckwith, the scientist from the University of Ottawa. Actually, he's sort of an independent scientist at this point, and he's calling us from Madrid at the COP25 climate conference. We're talking over some of the things that happened, and one of the things that happened, Time magazine's Person of the Year, Greta Thunberg, was allowed to address the delegates at one point. Of course, she wasn't included in the decision-making, but she said, finding holistic solutions is what the COP should be all about. But instead, it seems to have turned into an opportunity for countries to negotiate loopholes and to avoid raising their ambition, end quote, from Greta. And I know Australia is one of those loophole countries, and they're still trying to use some technical carbon credits from the Kyoto Agreement from the 1990s, and while they export ever more coal and gas. How is Canada doing? Was Canada even really active at these negotiations? Does Canada have any credibility left after building more tar sands pipelines by the government?
You know, I've heard almost nothing about Canada at this COP. a lot of the countries, they have, you know, they have a decent booth with lots of graphics and images and things about their country and what they're doing for climate. I mean, Canada has nothing like that. You have to search through the back hallways to find an office that says Canada on the door. And I actually went by there earlier today because I'd heard that David Suzuki and Elizabeth May were both here. So I went by with some fellow Canucks, and we wanted to find out, you know, get the latest information on Suzuki and Elizabeth May's whereabouts. And unfortunately, he left this yesterday, so we missed him. And she's still around, but they had, you know, it was a room full of people. They looked like they were doing some work or something, but really nothing's going on. And I think people are starting to recognize deceitful comments and, Orwellian type of behavior and, you know, sort of call it out more than just take people for at face value for what they say. I mean, I think Canada, you know, with the pipeline, has basically lost all international credibility on the climate file, to be honest, because they, especially young people, they say, you know, what's going on? Canada is not authentic. You know, it's still a fossil fuel producing country, and Trudeau tries to tap dance to keep everybody happy, and by doing that, he's not keeping anybody happy, right? I mean, he lost his base, basically. People felt betrayed by the whole pipeline purchasing. Yeah, I mean, he's not even bothering to show up to the conference.
We're too ashamed to show up, Paul. That's the real story there. And I remember in 1992, Canada was an environmental leader and respected around the world, but we've blown all that. So I also noticed, looking at the faces on the camera shots there of the conference, that there were hardly any Aboriginal people on the key insider meetings. And of course, environmental activists representing millions of people, like Greenpeace, were kept out. And Climate Change News reports, quote, 200 climate activists were forced out of the conference center on Wednesday afternoon by UN security after staging an undeclared protest in front of the talks plenary. Did you see any protests, Paul?
I saw some people protesting outside the conference when I came in. I think these things were later on in the day when I'd already been inside for quite a while. So I think I missed the main ones. So I did see the media frenzy when Greta was walking around, you know, going to different events and so on. It was just unbelievable, you know, to see these press behaving like psychotic kids chasing after, you know, this 16-year-old girl. I mean, Greta basically has rock star type status. Of course, the usual COP attendees like Al Gore was here and John Kerry was here. Sir David King gave some talk. Harrison Ford, I would have liked to have seen. He's one of my favorite actors, and he was here. I was hoping to see Leonardo DiCaprio, who's also done quite a bit for the climate situation. But you do see quite a lot of people. You see people. You just kind of bump into people. But I must say, you know, for me personally, one of the highlights of the conference in the last few days, when, you know, those are some of the key things. Also, there's lots of information to learn about, you know, different things that different countries are doing and so on. There was a very good section, very good booth set up by some Nordic countries on the cryosphere. So all about the Arctic, the permafrost, the sea ice, the glaciers up there, you know, some of the latest scientific papers on what's happening there. And of course, just a few days ago, the Arctic report card, I believe, was released. So, you know, Peter Carter and I have covered some of these things, with our press conferences. We've had three press conferences, the first on, you know, what's the scientific justification for a climate emergency, and the climate emergency in the oceans, and basically climate feedbacks and cascading feedbacks and things like that, extreme weather events. And we have another session tomorrow, another half-hour press conference. We'll probably talk more about extreme weather events and jet streams and things like that. I think those are some of the key things that people still don't completely understand. You know, why are we having these extreme weather events, and what's going to happen when you know, when there's no Arctic sea ice. And the interesting thing is, you know, this week I've also been following the American Geophysical Union conference, which is a scientific conference going on in San Francisco this week, and I follow it mostly on Twitter with the hashtag AGU100 or just AGU. You know, it's interesting because Michael Mann has a new paper where he's talking all about the baseline shift. You know, we're hiding some of the temperature rise because of the baseline shift, right? And stuff you might recognize that I've been talking about for years, it seems. I mean, the WMO report recently that came out just last week was saying we're 1.1 degrees Celsius, global average temperature, above the 19th century. But, you know, the 19th century, I mean, the 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius temperature targets that everybody talks about after Paris and before Paris, those are based on 1750 baseline, which is 0.3 degrees Celsius warmer already than the 19th century baseline. So that means we're 1.4 degrees above 1750. So that's the number we need to compare against the 1.5 and 2 degree target, right? It's just basic stuff. Like, it's not rocket science. It's just, but people, they lose sight of these things. And, you know, there's dishonesty in representing this to try to downplay the extent of the warming. And it was also a paper that came out about, you know, some new modeling work has shown, well, hey, the Arctic sea ice is actually going to disappear in the summer is much, much sooner than we think.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, surprise, surprise. And I, you know, I had a quick look at the paper and I couldn't even see where they, okay, so what are they saying now? When is, you know, much sooner than we think? Is that sooner than 2040, 2030? Like, what date are they talking about? And I couldn't find it in a quick scan of the initial paper. I mean, presumably there's something in there that shows what they mean by much sooner, but I mean, that's no surprise to Wadhams. It's no surprise to me. It's probably no surprise to any of your listeners, but lo and behold, it's a big surprise to the mainstream scientific community, who once again is way behind. They're always lagging in what they say and do still, right? Like, it's crazy. Scientific reticence. There you go.
It's scientific reticence, and then we have bureaucratic cowardice, I would say. I don't know, what does it mean now that after 25 years of meeting to try and stave off climate change, emissions are still going up, we're using more fossil fuels than ever globally, is it time to just ditch that whole process and try and do something else? Because it's not working.
Yeah, I think it's well past the time. You know, what's the point of, we know what we have to do, like to keep, I mean, this is one of the things that the Liberal government did their first year in power, you know, after they won in 2015. Well, let's hold hearings and see what people want done, right? And they just stalled and wasted an entire year. And then they wasted another year trying to figure out, you know, what sort of carbon price they would put on. And then they said it would be in by 2018. Well, they didn't mean beginning of 2018. They meant the end of 2018. Like, it's just delay. It's just, like, they're not serious at all.
That's in Canada. You're talking about in Canada.
Yeah, I mean, we know when they'll be serious, when there's no more subsidies to fossil fuels, right? When the subsidies are taken away from fossil fuels. And, I mean, what kind of a, you know, and they talk about a free market and let the market decide, and yet, and then they completely rig the market by making it favorable for fossil fuels, giving them huge subsidies and better, cleaner technologies that are up and coming. Solar, wind, they get some small subsidies, tiny compared to what fossil fuels get. And yet people complain, well, you know, they're being subsidized. And we're a funny species, you know, and when you put us all together and in our tribes and our countries and things, we can do some really stupid and bizarre things, you know, until finally sometimes we end up doing the right thing. But on climate, we just haven't seen that yet. But, you know, the young people are out on the streets by the millions, and there are things that are changing, right? There's glimmers of hope.
One of those glimmers is the fact that the cities are getting active. We just had a report from Rana Adib at REN 21 in Paris that thousands of cities are signing up for pretty extreme radical climate action and decarbonizing and electrifying their systems and all sorts of changes that the national governments can't begin to get to. So it could be that a climate revolution will just bypass the current elite and so-called leadership, but I don't know. Right now, it's looking kind of bleak. I'm very disappointed in this COP25. We're going to have to wrap it up there. Any closing words as we go out here, Paul?
Yeah, I think that the cities is a key point because, I mean, over about half of humans now live in cities, and that number is supposed to rise to 70 or 80%, you know, in a few decades. So the cities will have more and more and more sway within countries. So, you know, those trends towards cities really getting it, you know, down at the local sort of levels of individual cities, I think that's a key point. So, you know, I tell people that basically the air I'm breathing right now is probably about 600 or 700 parts per million. I mean, it's a room that's been full of people all day, but it's a large room. So if I need to lower the CO2 level, I just need to go outside or just need to open a window next to me and I can get it down to the nominal level of 400, right? So our society has yet to find that window that we can open on the earth to reduce CO2, you know, the magic bullet, if you like. I mean, you know, we need to sprinkle our efforts around all different ways to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. And if we come up with one winner and we can get it down quickly, then, you know, we've gone a long way towards addressing our issue of climate change. So when you put it in that sort of viewpoint, it doesn't seem like it's that, you know, insurmountable a problem. I mean, that's the key number, though. The greenhouse gas levels in the atmosphere, they're too high. They're continuing to rise at ever higher rates because we need to turn that curve. And until that curve slows down and is turned, you know, everything else has failed, really. And a lot of people are losing hope because it's still rising at ever faster rates. But once it starts to turn, that will encourage a lot of people, a lot of companies and things to turn it even more. And like I tell people, let's put the military around the world. You know, they don't need to kill people an extra 110th way. They've already got 109 ways of doing it. You know, they're very efficient at killing people. Let's put all these scientists and engineers and money towards preserving life on our planet and give them a couple of years with all of their funds and let's see what we can do to, say, pull CO2 out of the atmosphere. No, this is what I always try to remind people.
We have been speaking with the Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith, and I reached Paul Madrid at the close of the COP25 climate meeting. You can find Paul's great videos, including those from Madrid, and his climate emergency science presentations on his YouTube channel at paulbeckwith.net. Paul may be the first citizen-supported climate scientist I know about. Be sure and support Paul in his valuable work. That's paulbeckwith.net.
Radio EcoShock.
All said, it appears that the United Nations Organized Conference of the Parties remains a collection of carbon addicts always promising to rein in the drug trade. Sure, they never do. It is up to all of us to organize in new and different ways. We cannot give up on searching for ways to save what is left of the planet for our beloved descendants and all living things. See what you can do. I'm Alex Smith. Please keep listening and stay tuned for developments in climate science and activism on Radio EcoShock.
This program is a theoretical account of the worst-case scenario for global disaster. This is a real emergency.